content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Frank Urban from the North Carolina Reading Service. Welcome to another edition of Smithsonian. And we're reading from the December 2019 edition of Smithsonian. Blessed is the Hermit by Jenny Rothberg Greitz, G-R-I-T-Z. I don't think she'd want it pronounced Gritz. About 50 miles east of Santa Fe, New Mexico, in the Sangre de Cristo Mountains, Hermit Peak rises some 10,000 feet amid the pinyon juniper woodland of the Pecos Wilderness. The hermit for which it was named was an Italian-born monk, Giovanni Maria Agostini. For 3 years in the 1860s, Agostini lived high up on the mountain, foraging for food and getting water from a spring. Despite his self-imposed solitude, he managed to attract a following during an era of religious fervor and experimentation in America. At the end of the 19th century, a local organization created in his honor, the Society of the Hermit, counted 62 members. Their main practice was a long trek to the peak to pray and erect crosses. Today, the Society of Hermits' solemn tradition has faded almost to the vanishing point and might be entirely lost if not for one family. I go to Mass on Sundays and I take my kids, but I feel closer to God praying in that cave, remembering that my uncle used to be right here. And my grandpa used to be right here, said Joseph Abeta, a 36-year-old resident of Las Vegas, New Mexico. There are a handful of other society members still in the area, but this past September, the Abetas were the only ones who made the trek to Hermit Peak. The photographer Gabriel Ellison Scowcroft accompanied the family to document this unique rite of faith. The hermit himself was never part of any established parish or monastery. Agostini was born in 1801, and according to his writings, began to incline toward a solitary life at the age of 5. In his 30s, he joined the Maronite Church in Rome. Maronite Christians weren't mainstream in Italy. They're mostly found in Syria and Lebanon. But Agostini wanted to model himself on St. Anthony of Quoheia, that's spelled Q-O-Z-H-A-Y-A, a third-century Maronite who had spent 20 years in solitude and then founded the first Christian monastery. Agostini did the same thing St. Anthony did, says David Thomas, author of the biography of Agostini, Wonder of the Century, the astonishing world traveler who was a hermit. He would go to some spot, always picked a cave to live in, and then he would live exemplary primitive life there. Agostini traveled all over Europe and South America, crossing the Andes twice and canoeing down the continent's major rivers. Word spread whenever the bearded holy man appeared on a new mountaintop. Most hermits just want to live out in the middle of nowhere, says Thomas. This guy was very intelligent and very well educated. He had a purpose. Agostini attracted such a huge following in the Brazilian state of Rio Grande do Sul that the government arrested him. The state's top official wrote in a letter that the monk had encouraged great fanaticism about himself. In 1861, Agostini headed to Mexico, where he again attracted a large following and was sent to an insane asylum. Officials deported him to Havana after 5 months, citing the Mexican Constitution, which allows the government to expel any foreigner whose remaining he may deem inexpedient. From Cuba, Agostini took a steamship to New York, and then walked 370 miles to Montreal, where he got a chilly reception. The cold climate of New France seemed to have congealed the heart of its inhabitants, the hermit wrote in his journal. My ragged clothes and mean appearance did not appeal to the Canadians. His lack of French also made it hard for him to explain to the Quebecois why he looked and lived the way he did. They distrusted me and ran away from me. It was the saddest period of my life. After weighing the idea of going back to Italy, Agostini decided to explore the American West. When he joined a wagon train in Council Grove, Kansas, in August 1863, the Kansas City Times reported that the old monk refused to ride in the wagons and wouldn't sleep in a tent. Instead, he walked alongside the wagons and at night wrapped himself up in a coarse blanket to sleep under the stars. Arriving in New Mexico, a newly annexed U.S. territory, Agostini settled into his cave and practiced his daily devotions. Each Sunday, he walked to Las Vegas, New Mexico, for Mass. The Las Vegas Daily Optic reported that people for miles about were so impressed with the religious character of the newcomer that they commenced making pilgrimages in large numbers to his lonely dwelling. Visitors returned with stories about how the hermit had cured their ailments or made a spring appear by striking the earth with his staff. The hermit was killed in 1869 in another part of New Mexico by unknown attackers and found with his crucifix in his hand, wearing a cilice, C-I-L-I-C-E, and a septic's spiked iron belt that had been around his waist so long his skin had grown over it. The hermit's austere life and death are much in the thoughts of Joseph's father, Victor Abeta, as he makes his annual trek. The climb has been harder for him since he was hit by a car in 2004. He now has several metal plates and pins in the lower half of his body. We're still able to come to this place and use it like they did, he says, surveying the view from the top. And I'm fortunate enough to still be able to do it. And that was Blessed is the Hermit. Jenny Rothberg Greitz is a Smithsonian senior editor. I'll read the captions of some of the pictures. Joseph Abeta, who took part in the pilgrimage, sports a tattoo of the Virgin of Guadalupe. During Agostini's lifetime, some visitors to his cave on Hermit Peak claimed to see an image of the Virgin in the sky. And Agostini is shown with a portrait of the Virgin Mary on his arm and a mountain where the cave is located. Looks like it was taken at sundown. Another picture with a pack horse and people hiking up to the Hermit Peak. Following tradition, above, the Abetas and their pack horse hike up to Hermit Peak, visible in the distance. Along the way, pilgrims perform rites, such as the Stations of the Cross, which commemorate the death of Jesus. On the other page, we see Victor Abeta receiving a crucifix from his son. They look like they're along the path on the hike. Three pictures here of a crucifix. Looks like a book with the Virgin Mary on the front. Objects of devotion. The Abeta family crucifix, first carried by Victor's grandfather, Felipe Abeta, born in 1872. And then a handmade prayer book created by Victor's father, Jose Felipe Abeta II, born in 1929. That's the one that has the Virgin Mary on the cover. Abeta family rosaries on a hand-decorated picture frame inherited from Victor's grandmother, Maria Laura Martinez Abeta, born in 1890. A book carried by the president of the Sociedad del Hermitano contains prayers and hymns to be sung during the pilgrimage to Hermit Peak. And there's a picture of Tristan Abeta, 11, lights a candle at the hermit's cave during his fourth annual pilgrimage. On the right side, the abatis candles glow on behalf of deceased relatives, as well as the society of the hermit members who didn't make the long journey. And there are relics, a crucifix, and some candles burning, and picture of the Virgin Mary also at the base of some big mountain rocks. The mountaintop. In this picture, the abatis prepare to pray the rosary by the three crosses at the top of the mountain, and they're made out of sticks slashed together. A view of Las Vegas, New Mexico is seen on the opposite page from the summit of Hermit Peak. Abatis family ancestors came to the area in the 1600s. The picture is a very long shot from far away, maybe miles and miles away, with the last glimmer of sunlight shining on the horizon. Another picture, the spring. In a kind of baptismal renewal, Victor pours water on Joseph as his sons look on. The water's from the hermit's spring, which Agostini must have been grateful to discover. Previously, he survived on droplets falling into his cave. And now I go back to the title page. I skipped over the picture there. Giovanni Maria de Agostini, a peripatetic Italian monk who was banished from Brazil, reached northern New Mexico on foot in 1863. He holed up on a mountain that would become known as Hermit Peak, today the object of an annual pilgrimage. And this picture looks very, very old, maybe going back to the beginning of photography. I've read all the feature stories from the December edition of Smithsonian, so I'm going to look for other little stories we can fill in with. This is Hulking Airships Rise Again, Slowly. A world in a hurry turns to a lumbering early 20th century technology for a lesson in efficiency by April White. In the 1930s, before commercial airplanes began crossing the Atlantic, Zeppelins promised to change how we traveled. They could make the voyage in just 43 hours, while the fastest ocean liner took 5 days. But when the Hindenburg plummeted from the New Jersey sky in 1937, killing 36 people, the disaster also ended the dream that hydrogen-filled airships would be the future of transportation. Now scientists and others are starting to look at Zeppelins as something more than hovering billboards, like the Goodyear blimp. The reason is a benefit that went unrecognized a century ago. Airships can be more fuel efficient than cargo ships and airplanes. Most modern airships use helium, a non-flammable but expensive and rare gas. But technological advances have lessened the explosive danger associated with hydrogen, which is endlessly abundant. So the military, space agencies, and others are stepping up research on hydrogen-filled airships, and cargo transport could be speedy as well as efficient. A new study in the Journal of Energy Conversion and Management found that an airship 5 times the length of the Empire State Building, riding the jet stream, could circle the globe in 14 days, faster than any ocean-going ship. And there are 2 photos here. The Navy's short-lived USS Macon in 1933 and a commercial passenger airship in 2014. And now we'll go to the discussion page of Smithsonian. That's in the front. And they have a picture of last month's Smithsonian with the article Call of the Wild. And the editors have something to say about that. I do believe the spirit of Jack London was with Richard Grant, Tanya Eisen in Medford, Oregon, wrote about our November cover story, retracing the Call of the Wild, author's Yukon journey. Fantastic writing and a true adventure to read. Don Pike of Crawford, Texas, was struck by Behind the Lines, about a secret mission to capture Nazi mapping data. We are all certainly indebted to these courageous people and the risks and sacrifices they endured. The story that provoked the biggest response, most of it admittedly negative, was Shay's Kid Hits the Road, about a motorcycle tour of Cuba given by a son of Che Guevara, one of the leaders of the country's revolution. Though the travel article mentioned Shay's brutality, many readers said the piece glorified the rebel leader and didn't go far enough in criticizing the communist government. And here's from a reader, Paula Eastwood of Albuquerque, New Mexico, The Map Hunters. My sister Holly and I grew up with these stories, and only later, when our father, Ray Johnson, committed them to writing, did we understand the impact of these events on his life. Now, to see some of the same observations put into a deeply researched narrative is very powerful and moving. He never dreamed that his manuscript would contribute to an important and intriguing national story. That makes me want to go back and read that in the November edition of Smithsonian. George Clark of Wisconsin Rapids, Wisconsin. My father was a scout slash ranger with the 4th Infantry Division, spotting artillery as a forward observer from Utah Beach to the occupation of Germany. I imagine the data gleaned from the recovered documents was applied by the 29th Field Artillery as it battled across Europe, information that aided his survival and my eventual existence. Here's another comment on Che Guevara from Daryl Engel, Chandler, Arizona. What a whitewashing of the life and effect of the Che Guevara Kids Hit Home, Kids Hit the Road. Although he helped Castro dispose of a dictator, what was the result? He helped create and support an even more repressive regime, from which thousands have been desperate to escape over the past 60 years. No one immigrates to Cuba. It has never been able to support itself under this regime, and the non-elites are unvaryingly suffering from shortages of food and medicine. A more balanced article would better serve your readership. And Steve Moore of Oceanside, California says, maybe you could interview some of the Cuban-Americans who survived Castro and Che's regime. They would have a different perspective on what kind of man Che was. D. L. Moore of Hesperia, California writes, what a treasure trove. As we now head toward a totally digital world, these letters, the news from over there, are an invaluable look at a world before iPhones and computers. They give us a window into not only the day-to-day lives of these fighting men, but also the day-to-day lives of their families, something no newsreel will ever show. And Christy Collins of Goshen, New York, I am moved by the dedication of Mr. Carroll and his staff in this endeavor. It is a vital opportunity and responsibility to collect, save, and cherish the thoughts and feelings of our military. Now, I'm really tempted to go back and read last month's Smithsonian. Now, we jump to a single-column story under Art. Before Audubon, an 18th-century album of India's flora and fauna showcases the startling work of an overlooked master, by Amy Crawford. An 18th-century album of India's flora and fauna showcases the startling work of an overlooked master. In the late 1770s, a British colonel, official named Sir Elijah Impey, I-M-P-E-Y, and his wife, Lady Mary, commissioned the Indian artist Shaka Zain Uddin to catalog a private menagerie, including various bird species the couple had assembled at their home in Calcutta. Using paper and watercolors from England, Zain Uddin, a Muslim from the city of Patna, modeled his work after English botanical illustration, but he also brought to the job his training in the ornate Mughal, M-U-G-H-A-L, artistic tradition, and his own distinctive style. Today, critics praise the quality of the colors and the composition, in which a bright, simple background offsets the keenly wrought details, plants, and animals. Everything is incredibly precise and beautifully observant, says Xavier Bray, director of London's Wallace Collection, which this month mounts the first UK exhibition of works by Indian artists commissioned by officers of the British East India Company. The expat aristocrats who patronize Zain Uddin and his fellow artists had been sent abroad to help manage their country's growing empire. But once there, many, like the Impis, fell in love with the subcontinent as well as its flora and fauna. These paintings, Bray says, were made into albums to be leafed through back home on a rainy day, drinking Earl Grey tea. History failed to record much about Zain Uddin's life beyond his watercolors for the Impis. But the new show, which includes 99 paintings of nature studies, portraits, and landscapes by 18 artists, makes an argument that he and his contemporaries should be recognized on their own merits as some of India's greatest painters. Anything with a colonial air about it is now considered politically incorrect, Bray says. But what we are trying to do is bring back these extraordinary artists who have been almost completely forgotten. Up next, The Luminous Truth. The artist who famously painted a first lady creates revelatory portraits of ordinary people, by Tiffany Y. Ates, A-T-E-S. Amy Sherald was living in Baltimore and finishing up a graduate degree in fine art when, at age 30, she was diagnosed with a serious heart condition. 9 years later, in 2012, after a harrowing blackout episode, she received a heart transplant, which renewed her commitment to painting as well as to her health. In 2016, she submitted one of her paintings, a portrait called Miss Everything, (parenthesis, unsuppressed deliverance), featuring an elegant African-American woman holding an oversized teacup, to the Smithsonian National Portrait Gallery's Outwin Buchever Portrait Competition. No woman had won the contest in its 12 years. The night of the award announcement, I thought, I'm not going to get one, Sherald recalls. Then I heard my name. She took the grand prize. Sherald creates innovative, dynamic portraits that, through color and form, confront the psychological effects of stereotypical imagery on African-American subjects, the citation said. The next year, First Lady Michelle Obama selected Sherald to paint her official portrait, bringing unimagined public attention. When the painting was unveiled in 2018, it drove record numbers of visitors to the National Portrait Gallery. So many, the work was relocated to a larger room to accommodate the crowds. This past fall, crowds flocked to view Sherald's first New York solo exhibition at the Hauser and Wirth Gallery. The show, titled The Heart of the Matter, consists of 8 new portraits in rainbow hues, starring ordinary people Sherald had encountered by chance in Baltimore and New York, and later photographed at her studio. Her subjects' complexions, however, are painted in Sherald's signature grisaille, or a grayscale, an absence of color that directly challenges perceptions of black identity, the gallery says. Nearly life-size, dressed casually or in work uniforms or in their Sunday best, her subjects invite viewers to linger and reflect. The gigantic 9-foot by 10-foot painting, If You Surrendered to the Air, You Could Ride It, the title comes from Toni Morrison's Song of Solomon, shows a young man perched on a green construction beam, gazing toward and above the viewer, an ode to Charles C. Ebbett's iconic photograph, Lunch Atop a Skyscraper, that also subtly comments on the overlooked triumphs of black laborers in America. Another painting, Sometimes the King is a Woman, shows a self-assured woman in a striking black-and-white zigzag pattern dress against a bright pink background. Her unassuming yellow earrings seem to whisper a charge to women everywhere. The time is now, perhaps. On a brisk October afternoon, a line wraps around the block outside Hauser and Wirth in Manhattan. Inside, stylish patrons chat and snap selfies and stare at Charlotte's monumental paintings. In a back office, the artist sits with her dog, August Wilson, named for the playwright, to speak with Smithsonian. What would people be surprised to know about you? Many might be surprised to find out that if I wasn't an artist, I might be a chef. I was really good at cooking at a young age. As I work, I'll have the Netflix series Chef's Table playing in the background because I find inspiration in their practices and what they do. We're both working with these very basic rudimentary tools. Broccoli is always going to be broccoli. There's no new vegetable that's going to pop up. Similarly, I work with brushes and paint. We take these tools and make something wonderful out of them. How did winning the National Portrait Gallery's competition affect your career? The $50 submission fee is the best investment I ever made. I knew at that point in my career, after my heart transplant recovery, I needed something to put me out there. It definitely put me on the international stage and introduced many people to my craft. From there, I obtained gallery status, which exposed my work to the art market. The painting sold, and then suddenly there was a waiting line. I began a crazy work schedule, knowing I needed to produce 12 paintings a year. Do you feel pressure to create art with a social justice bent? A black person on a canvas is automatically read as radical. In hindsight, I look back and I'm like, that's why my fingers are gray. I didn't want the conversation to be marginalized, and I had a fear of that early on. My figures needed to be pushed into the world in a universal way, where they could become a part of the mainstream art historical narrative. What's next for you? Right now I'm focused on being in the studio. More museum spaces that I can fill up, the more challenging these paintings can project. They can be employed in many different ways, but hanging them on walls as acceptable public spaces is essential. If you know African American history, then you recognize the power of their presence. That's going to wrap up this year for Smithsonian. We hope you've enjoyed today's reading. Be sure to listen next time. I'm Frank Urban, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Kappen. We thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long until next year. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138.